3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Joe Tate, and I have a podcast. It's called Over the Timeline. I look back at the highlights and a few lowlights of my sports broadcast career. Over the Timeline, brought to you by the Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
Welcome back to another edition of the Over the Timeline podcast with the great Joe Tate. It's brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Medina, and Westlake. My name is Andy Volbarch, joined by Joe Tate as always. And Joe, we're going to have a lot of fun with this one because anybody that's spent any time in the broadcast business, especially in baseball, doing the pregame interview, it can be a lot of fun. But when you get in to that third or fourth month of the season, well, trying to find a subject for that pregame interview, that can be a little interesting, my friend.
Yes, by the time you've talked to Oscar Gamble six times, and all Oscar wants to talk about is, you know, what kind of a day it is or his latest afro, you do kind of run a little stale.
Yeah, when you're talking about hairstyles during the dugout interview or the pregame interview, that probably tells you where the subject matter has gone over the last few months. Now, this one in particular today that we're going to focus on, it happened back in 1978. The dugout interview that you did with British consulate Leslie Reed. And I got to thinking, listening to some of the clips of this interview, boy, that had to be an interesting conversation. It was hilarious because you guys really cover the gamut over about 6 minutes and change. You talk about cricket, you talk about soccer, so you found a way to get legs out of this interview.
Well, yeah, I mean, you get somebody, and you hit it right on the button. You get somebody that you figure is going to say something other than what you've been listening to for the last 2 months. You know, you want to get into it and fill up the time and in hopes that he can speak well. And it was apparent right off the top of the page. He was very well spoken, and it went from there.
It was a very interesting interview. We've got four different cuts of the interview that we're going to play before we get into the first one, where basically you get into the nuts and bolts with Leslie Reed. I want to talk about something that you and I discussed a few moments ago before we started the recorder here about the great Ernie Harwell. And it was he who stated, you know, when somebody asked him many, many years ago, what's your least favorite part of doing the broadcast? And he said, by far, it's the pregame interview because you get a couple of months into the season and it is just so difficult to spice it up and make it sound different than the night before because you can only talk to the manager so many times before you start asking the same questions 15 times over. Same thing with the starting pitchers you mentioned with Oscar Gamble, and the list goes on. But you mentioned that you and Ernie Harwell actually had each other on as pregame interview subjects.
Absolutely. It was kind of a reciprocal trade agreement. He'd talk to me on his show, and I talked to him on my show. And I came out the better of it because I always got a pair of Sibley shoes from Ernie. And I think the key to that, what you're saying, Bull, is people who listened to Ernie Harwell for many, many years with the Detroit Tigers, they never knew that that's how he felt. Because he was a consummate pro at everything he did. Ernie Harwell was one of the guys that I really admired the most in our business.
Well, and Ernie was just a legend. I mean, for so many years, it was such a pleasure to listen to him. Because when you heard that voice, he was one of those voices that remind you, baseball in the summer.
Amen.
I mean, you know, the sound of Ernie's voice was synonymous with the smell of the hot dogs and the crack of the bat, all that good stuff.
Amen. Yeah, he was the pro's pro.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, what I find fascinating about this interview is the way you open things up, and you talk to Leslie Reed about his time in Cleveland. You actually caught him at the tail end of his time in Cleveland. So let's get to that first cut of this interview as Joe Tate sat down with British consulate Leslie Reed.
This is Joe Tate with Dugout Interviews, and via tape recording, we're going to add a little class to the show this evening because we are chatting with the British consul, Sir Leslie Reed, who is going to pack it up and head for home. We talked about this last night. He is retiring, and Leslie, I understand in your time that you have spent here in Cleveland, Ohio, as the British consul, that you have developed an interest in the Cleveland Indians.
Yes, I've been under instruction by Dr. Wilder here, who brought me along to see you. I suppose I can claim to know as much about baseball as the average Englishman by now, Joe.
Well, that may put you in league with a goodly number of Americans as well.
It doesn't follow I know very much about it all the same. But I must have enjoyed watching the Indians, and I'm only sorry that you haven't gone up to the top of the table before I go. I'm expecting to get some reports sent back to England of steady progress over the year.
Do you anticipate and are you optimistic that you will be able to receive such progress reports in the future?
I should be very disappointed if somebody doesn't tell me how you're going on. If I don't get any reports, I'll assume you're still the bottom of the table.
Pretty safe assumption back in the late 70s, no question about that. But, you know, listening to that cut, it's interesting how right away he immediately opened up. And we were talking about this before we came on the air with this. You know, sometimes interview subjects just kind of fall into your lap when you're looking for something different a little bit later in the year. Sometimes instances like these just kind of fall into your lap. Do you remember how this interview came to?
Yes, Dr. Bill Wilder, who was the Indians team doctor for at least 30 years and probably longer. It was also my own personal physician. He was the guy who set it up, and so that's how I got to know Leslie right off the top of the page was through Dr. Wilder, and Dr. Wilder kept Leslie informed of the Indians' progress or lack of after Leslie had gone back to Great Britain.
Well, hopefully a couple of years later, he caught wind of Len Barker's perfect game. I mean, that was probably the most exciting part of the next 5 years or so. But, you know, the other interesting thing, too, about interviews like this, I mean, you don't have a whole lot of an opportunity to do a whole lot of preparation. And I think that's what's fascinating about this interview is that it comes off seamless, like you and Leslie Reed had known each other for years.
Well, I think a lot of that's due to Leslie Reed, who, as a British counsel, is used to talking to Americans and getting away with it very well. So I just was along for the ride because he was very, very easy to talk to. And Dr. Wilder set the table for me, too.
No question about it. Well, let's play another clip from this interview because after talking about him keeping tabs on the Indians, you went right to cricket, which I thought was a fantastic move, trying to keep the conversation moving because, well, what's more English and baseball tied in than cricket itself? So here's the clip where you ask him about cricket.
They say that cricket and baseball have a great deal of similarities, and I must confess to you, I have never seen a game of cricket, so I don't know whether that is true or not. Are there similarities between the two sports?
Well, they both use a ball, and I wouldn't say there's much more to it than that. Cricket's a much more leisurely game. I don't think it's got the same sort of verve as baseball. The essential difference, really, is that in cricket, the ball strikes the ground before it gets to the batsman. So instead of doing things through the air, it also does things off the wicket, and this gives it another dimension. So I think it's slightly more complicated, but there really is no comparison, excepting that they both are national games in some way. But I'm looking forward to seeing some cricket this summer.
What about the sports fan in England as compared to the sports fan in the United States? Are they as rabid? How do they take their sports in England?
Well, if you're talking about cricket, they're less noisy than baseball, no question about that. If you're talking about soccer, which is the winter game, then I'm afraid the fans are not only noisy, they're sometimes quite obstreperous, and I sometimes worry a little bit about the sort of hooliganism associated with soccer. There's nothing of this colour, no organs, no sort of background and razzmatazz in cricket. There's no comparison between the two.
A couple of things come out of that, my friend, and we're going to come back around to the whole soccer aspect of that answer. We're going to save that for the second half of the podcast, but I think at the very end there, part of what he mentions is part of what has made baseball great over all these years. You know, you could hear a little bit there in the clip as well. You could hear the organ playing in the background, and, you know, during the interview, you really kind of captured the atmosphere being down there in the dugout. You could hear some of the crowd noise. That's really one of the things that for all these years has helped to set baseball apart.
And on top of that, Bull, the word obstreperous is heard for the first time in the history of broadcasting in a dugout interview.
I don't even know what that means. Do you have any idea?
I don't think it's good.
All right, fair enough. I mean, I could look it up a little bit later, but off the top of my head, I have no idea what that means. And I mean, I caught a snippet of it there as we were listening to it, but it's interesting, too, to hear how he describes the atmosphere of baseball, because that's something that for someone who hasn't seen it for the first time seems to stand out to me. You never really expect to hear about that in a dugout interview, because the dugout interview, I think, in some ways captures the calm before the storm. But the atmosphere is what's made the game great over all these years, and I thought it was interesting to hear from him how that stood out above all else, the differences between baseball and cricket, but the atmosphere of the game is what really blew him away.
Yeah, and I have since seen a game of cricket, at least in part, and boy, he's absolutely right. You know, to an American baseball fan, cricket could put you to sleep in a hurry. Although I've seen some pitchers who bounce the ball coming to home plate more than once, so they'd fit right into a cricket match.
Yeah, well, and there are some pitchers that like to do their taxes, have a cup of coffee, roast some marshmallows before they make a pitch, and they can put you to sleep in a hurry as well.
Right.
So I'm sure between the two of us, we've seen at least our fair share over the years. So what were your major takeaways from seeing cricket? Did you watch it on TV, or where exactly did you see this?
I saw it on television, and I thought, remembering my conversation with Leslie, you know what? He's absolutely right. It's a gentleman's game, and there's a decorum with cricket. You know, well struck. Yeah, that is an out-and-out crowd eruption is, well struck.
Well, my friend, so that we could stay within the guidelines of the FCC and such, I could think of a phrase that rhymes with that's used in baseball quite frequently, but we can't repeat that on the air. And I think that, in and of itself, tells you all you need to know about the difference between cricket and baseball, for sure. Well, what else about the atmosphere?
That was well
cricket?
Struck, by the way, Bull.
Oh, thank you. We can't mince words and letters here, I guess, but what was it about the atmosphere of cricket that really kind of made you sit back and think, boy, this is the kind of thing that certainly works over there but really wouldn't work over here? I mean, were there any concession stands, any of those things that you saw?
Genteel applause.
Okay.
And, you know, and things like, yes, well struck. That just sticks in my mind it's a gentleman's game. And it's a game played leisurely. They take a long time to play cricket. And although there's action, it's almost programmed action. And there's probably some Englishman listening to me saying, why, you blimey, you know, I'd like to get you and well struck you right on the spot.
Seems like it's very much like a golf environment. At least that's what it sounds like to me.
Well struck, yes.
We are going to rename this the Well Struck edition of the Over the Timeline podcast. We need to step aside and take a break after we hear these messages from Life Care Centers of Elyria, Medina, and Westlake.
He was a voice heard by Cleveland Cavalier and Cleveland Indians fans for decades.
There's a long drive to left field!
Until illness struck.
I've been at Life Care twice. Both times, they helped me fight my way back home. It wasn't easy, but I came back.
Meet Joe Tate.
Life Care helped get me back on my feet.
Real people, real heroes. Life Care Centers of America.
With locations in Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
Welcome back to the Over the Timeline podcast with the great Joe Tate. This has been deemed the Well Struck edition, brought to you by the Life Care Centers of Elyria, Medina, and Westlake. And we are going back in time to 1978, discussing Joe Tate's dugout interview with British consulate Leslie Reed. And we were talking about how Leslie Reed was comparing cricket to baseball, talking about how the atmospheres were wildly different. And we're going to get into some of the other sports in England that he compared to baseball, one of which, Joe, he goes into was soccer. Now, he alluded to it a little bit in that second clip that we played. How much soccer have you watched over the years?
Well, I broadcast soccer, and both indoor and outdoor soccer. And there's no comparison between the fans in this country and the fans in Europe or South America, when it comes to soccer in those venues, they make moats around soccer fields in some parts of the world because the fans are, well, let me put it to you this way. It's the dog pound on steroids. So those people go crazy. I mean, I do watch on occasion soccer on TV. I happen to like the sport, but boy, they can really get into it as far as the enthusiasm for the sport itself.
They do get into it, sometimes a bit too much. I mean, we've all heard a crazy soccer story or two in our lives. I mean, I remember the one where there was a referee that was essentially chased out of the stadium. He had to grab his car keys, and he did a dead sprint to avoid the wildly crazy fans. So let's play this third clip of the interview where British consulate Leslie Reed talks about some of those crazy soccer fans.
Leslie, I know we have heard stories of some of the problems that have come about at English soccer games. Has the country taken some steps to hold it down or to end that sort of thing?
Yes, I think there's a lot of anxiety about it. And I understand that in some of the grounds now, they've installed a kind of mesh screen so that the crowds, at any rate, can't invade the pitches. So I think the answer is very simple, that if they would put seats into the grounds and sell them as you do here at your football games, and people could be identified, all these things would fall away. But they really are it's a sort of a mass psychology. The chaps stand on the terraces. Anyway, I suppose as long as it doesn't get out of hand, it is a sort of a lightning conductor for some of the violent attitudes.
Do you feel that American baseball could ever catch on and become popular in England?
Honestly, no. I don't think so. I think you've really got... It depends what you're brought up to do. It's rather like soccer in your schools here. As more and more people learn to play it, then it will take hold, I think. But of course we play rounders in school. I didn't say this really, must I? But it's not the same kind of thing. But I really don't think baseball would take on somehow.
If nothing else, Joe, you have to love the honesty, right? I mean, he was pretty blunt with that, knowing that baseball would never pick up in England. But I also thought it was fascinating there listening to him talk about some of the measures that even back in the late 70s they were trying to take in order to make soccer a little bit safer. You had talked about the moats, and he mentions in there that, you know, they were trying to individualize seats, hoping that that might help to identify some of those that were getting a little bit out of hand. And well, they've tried that here, too, and that really hasn't seemed to regulate any of the violent nature that we see in some sports around here.
You know, what I thought as I was listening to that interview, the professional football going to England, and I guess doing well, they're drawing big crowds, I would have enjoyed in the 70s asking him, do you ever think professional football would go in England, and to hear his response to it. I don't know how he would answer it, but it, at least on a limited basis, has done rather well in England.
Which is really interesting, too, because back in the late 70s, the NFL was popular, but it's not the animal that it is today. And, I mean, you could certainly speak to that because you were right at the forefront of both the NBA and, of course, Major League Baseball back then. But where did the NFL fit in back then, as far as where it ranked amongst the major sports in the U.S. anyways?
Well, it was coming. It was getting bigger and better. I think at the time, the baseball and football probably were, you know, depends on how your team's doing as to whether it was number one or number two, and then basketball number three. But that's basically the way it is now, except football is number one. And baseball and basketball are jockeying for that runner-up spot.
And what's interesting, too, is, as you mentioned, I think the question would have probably caught him off guard to a certain degree, because I think that was kind of one of those ideas. It didn't really come to fruition until, 15 years later when they tried the NFL Europe idea. But back then, it probably would have sounded like an idea that came from way out in left field. But yep, you're right. You think about what football was back then. Could it have worked overseas?
Yeah, I don't know. Would it work because the NFL Europe League they were playing over there, you know, it had a modicum of success, but it was not anything that you'd want to really stake your financial future on.
And the major difference, too, is you didn't have the best of the best playing in the NFL Europe circuit, whereas now you have a couple of games that jump across the pond. It's a regular season game, so maybe you're not getting the absolute best of the best, depending on what teams are being sent over there, but it's a regular season product where you have some of the best, so it makes a little bit more sense. But you're right, that would have been a really interesting question to ask him back in 1978, because the answer would have been much, much different than today. One more interview clip I want to play here, and this one goes on for about a minute and a half, where you ask Leslie Reed, do you think that maybe Cleveland gets a bit of a bad rap?
You feel that Cleveland in this country has received, as they say in this country, a bad rap? In other words, the reputation of the city of Cleveland is really not what they like to make it out as elsewhere?
Well, yes, I'm afraid this is so. You know, somehow they've got themselves into this situation. So far as we're concerned, and we can give an entirely unbiased opinion, it's a very nice city in which to live. You've got a great deal going for you here. And you mustn't let this sort of adverse publicity get you down. You're going to get out of this, and certainly wherever I go, I shall be an advocate for Cleveland and tell them that it's a good place to live in.
What do you plan to do when you get home?
Grow cabbages, I think.
Leslie Reed, it is a pleasure to have met you. You have made your annual visits to our booth, and this time we broke out the tape recorder to wish you well, and I know I speak on behalf of probably everyone who has met you in your stay here when we do wish you the very best. Have a very safe trip home, and when the Indians come back to the top of the table, as you say, we hope you'll come back and be part of what probably will be the most exciting year in sports in the city.
Thank you, Joe, and I hope you will interview me again, and I can tell you how I feel about it.
Very good. Leslie Reed, the retiring British consul who will be going back to the British Isles, our guest here tonight on Dugout Interviews, and Leslie receives a gift certificate from J.B. Robinson Jewelers, the ringleader. Now, how about that? He can probably frame it and put it up on the wall at home and try to explain that to his English neighbors.
I left that last little bit in there for a reason, because I don't know that it still exists today where the interview subject still gets a gift certificate of some kind. The last time you and I talked, I think we had discussed how you were doing your last game and your first tenure with the Cavaliers, and you mentioned you were going to keep the gift certificate. You talked to us earlier about how you and Ernie Harwell would go back and forth with the dugout interview, and you ended up getting a lot of different shoes as a result. Then Ernie Harwell probably ended up getting a fine selection of jewelry for himself, for his wife, for whomever. He didn't have to go Christmas shopping as often, so everybody benefits. Any idea what in the world Leslie Reed would have done with that gift certificate?
I think he probably would have done one of two things, either framed it and shown it to his neighbors, or ground it up and put it out there to make the cabbages grow.
Some pretty expensive cabbages, I hope. Jeez, oh man. But that's why I left that in there at the very end. I always found that interesting how the gift card was passed on to anyone that participated in the dugout interview. But I also thought it was cool, too, at the beginning. He talked about how he believed, yeah, Cleveland absolutely does kind of get a bad rap. And Cleveland today, wildly different than it was back in 1978. You know, we're talking 40-plus years later. But, you know, what were some of the things back then that gave Cleveland such a bad rap, not only from a nationwide perspective, but in this case, a global perspective?
Can you say laughing? Those people spent half the show some nights denigrating Cleveland. And it was late night talk shows. You know, they all were taking shots at Cleveland. It was the punchline that got an easy laugh. So, yeah, it was unfair and uncalled for. Yeah, there were, you know, things like the river burning and things of that nature that did help it along. But Cleveland has never been as bad as the national media tried to make it out to be.
In future interviews, you and I are going to sit down and talk about some other dugout and pregame interviews as well. I do want to ask you about one that you did when you were with the Cavaliers. Tim Alcorn brought this to my attention yesterday, and I said, this is too good to pass up. I've got to ask you about the interview that you did many moons ago with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Now, it seemed like back then, Kareem was one of those guys that was very dialed in, sometimes could be tough to get a hold of, and, well, let's just say that the way in which you had to conduct this interview, you had to be a little flexible.
That's right, and the only reason I got it was because he had just written a book, And so he was opening himself to the great unwashed out there who could come talk to him whenever he said it was, you know, proper to do so. And I got him in the locker room. He was on the floor, and he was going through his pregame ritual of sit-ups and bending and twisting, and I had to give my question to him, but time it to the point where he would come back, and if he'd get the microphone in front of his mouth for the answer. I got a bigger workout that day than he did, believe me, and it was not a real good interview.
So I guess that was my next question with Kareem, because as far as I've been told, Kareem was a bit of an acquired taste over the years. I mean, he was one of those guys that if you knew him fairly well, he was a pretty easy guy to deal with, but could be a little bit rough around the edges. How was he with you that day? Do you remember?
Yeah, he did the interview because he had to. I mean, somebody told him, you got to do these interviews when you go around the league because it's going to help sell the book. And so he was doing the interviews under duress, so to speak, and it came across. He was not interested in doing an interview, and he made it just that much more difficult by doing these exercises while I was trying to talk to him.
Well, you had to be flexible physically, and you had to be flexible with your availability of that interview, I guess, as well. So,
amen.
Joe, this was awesome. This is a lot of fun. Boy, we covered a lot of ground today, from the British consulate to Wellstruck and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We covered a ton of ground here over the last 25 minutes and change. Always a pleasure, my friend, and I look forward to doing another one of these again soon.
Thanks, Bull.
Thank you, Joe. Again, that's the great Joe Tate. And this has been another edition of the Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Medina, and Westlake.